Hello and welcome once again to Lichtman and Rizov live, in air quotes, at Grassroots Tavern. I'm John Lichtman, contributor for The House Next Door, moderator, and all-around nice guy.
I'm Vadim Rizov. I'm here.
And perpetually awkward.
Thank you.
Tonight we are joined by our special guest for our unofficial Oscar podcast, S.T. Van Arsdale, editor of The Reeler and contributor to VanityFair.com's Little Gold Men blog. And as always, we are joined by Keith Ulick, editor of the podcast.
Hello, how are you? And Stu should say hello too. So,
oh, hi.
That's Stu.
That's
hello.
Stu.
ST, in other words. And finally.
And finally, special guest Kaveri
Marate.
There. Media mogul, media gadfly, and lucky enough to sit in tonight.
An all-around fabulous person.
That
indeed.
Too.
In token minority.
Looks fabulous, sounds fabulous, just fabulous in every way you can imagine.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Agreed.
Let's go on first to Roy Scheider.
Roy motherfucking Scheider, he said.
That's right.
Yes.
Passed earlier in the week due to...
complications from a staph infection, but he had been suffering from multiple myeloma.
Myeloma, right.
For 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah, he was 75, I think, and...
It was his time.
Well, yes, of course, you know, one of those who I am sad to have had taken from us, I'd say. You
right.
know, even in his later years, his Sequest DSVN post years. I mean, you know, he still was always a welcome presence. And I think I came across this thing on YouTube. I know I did actually, where this which is like a theater chain advertisement that he did, where it was basically just like throwing famous Roy Scheider lines back and forth at him while he was pitching another project to these people entirely. And he was even, you know, he had a self-deprecating sense of humor in that. And I think even there, he was a great presence to have. So.
Yeah. How many famous Roy Scheider lines are there, though? I mean, I know obviously there's...
We're going to need a bigger boat,
right,
obviously. It's Showtime, folks,
yeah, okay,
from all
right,
that jazz. French Connection, I'm sure he has one or two. I mean, of course, let me see. Okay, Pick Your Feet in Poughkeepsie is Hackman, right? Or,
right.
You know, I don't
someone
remember.
Asked him, and he says, are you still keeping your feet in Poughkeepsie, Papa?
Mm.
So it's got to be something else. I don't know if you tried it.
And actually, though, Glenn Kenny, God bless him, did write on his blog about the Roy Scheider look. This kind of don't bullshit me look kind of thing that I think is very true. So maybe he's more of a strong, silent type in that way. Yeah.
I feel particularly awful at the last Roy Scheider film I saw,
mm-hmm.
The Punisher.
Oh.
That is, I will probably go to hell for that. But
now,
Frank, you always have to clean your guns, Frank. Clean your guns.
Well, let's go around and say favorite Roy Scheider performances.
Kaveri.
Oh, I don't even know who he is.
Oh.
Good, Stu.
Probably my favorite Roy Scheider performances is Buddy Russo in French Connection.
Mm.
It's just one of those films where you've got such a major power in Gene Hackman. He knows when to defer to his leading man, and he knows when to kind of take over, and then that dynamic is not very easy to navigate, and he did so quite well, I think, and that Hackman also knew when to kind of let him, you know, run with the scene. Their relationship in that film was something pretty special, I think, and maybe taken for granted, and anyone who was revived last year at Film Forum, it was something I took special note of and asked Willie Fricke about, and he basically said the same thing. He said it was just a very special partnership. He cast Scheider again in Sorcerer years later. Not years, but I mean like 4 years later, I think. Yeah. And I think, you know, he saw something in him that a lot of people saw. Just a very compassionate, humane ability to, you know, to carry a film or let it be carried.
Certainly for me it would be All That Jazz. I think not just being Bob Fosse's best film in my opinion, but how Scheider kind of channels Fosse as a bibliographical fictional character.
It was a biographical fictional character. The first movie I saw this year, and it's really bad thing to watch within years, Hangover, because it's such a scarily acute portrait of like self-conscious male egomania that
yes.
can't stop itself.
Yeah.
And he pulls off the biggest dance number that I don't think anyone who wasn't musically trained could ever be expected to pull off.
The Bye Bye Life number?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, on the DVD, he talks about, for All That Jazz, he talks about training for that sequence and how his body hurts, like, after the 12 hours of the first day. And then he would go home on rest, you'd come back and do it all over again. And it was sort of this slow, steady process of, like, you know, getting into that kind of dance shape. And of course, he was never as strong as Nemberine or any of the others, but still, he held his own in that, and not just, you know, musically, but also performatively. I mean, I think that's, you know, he's not afraid to be a real bastard in that movie, and I think it was just something special about him that he was able to do that. And compared to with Chief Brody, his very identifiable character from Jaws, you know, I think he did have tremendous range in a certain way. So,
but forevermore, like, he got typecast as Chief Brody.
Yeah.
Even got dropped. Was it like Jaws 3 he gets brought back in? Where the
Jaws 2,
but isn't Jaws 3 like the continuation?
Oh, that's Roy Schneider.
Yeah, Chief Brody.
Oh, Chief Brody died?
Yes.
Oh no, I'm so sad. I feel bad about my asthma now.
There you go. But no, Jaws 3 is Jaws 3 is a continuation of the Brody clan, in a sense. But then there's Jaws 4, which is also the Brody clan, but not the same Brody clan as in 3. So 3 kind of, like, never happened, jumping to 4.
But Lorraine Gary comes back.
Lorraine Gary
and
comes back
Caine.
In 4. Yes.
Yeah, which was fantastic. And Mario Van Peebles' death scene in that film is really spectacular.
Except in the cut where he doesn't die. Because there's several different cuts of Jaws 4, and one of them is where Mario Van Peebles comes up at the end half chewed. He's like, "Hey man, I'm okay."
We're gonna need a bigger boat.
We're gonna need a bigger boat, exactly.
But the scene where he's actually getting carried underwater, you know, in the shark's mouth. I mean, I can still visualize that. That was a very haunting image. I mean, it's even more haunting than, you know, like Michael Caine, you know, coming out of the water dry,
completely basically. Dry, yeah. As Siskel and Ebert pointed out. Yeah.
I like to think that the shark with Van Peebles was, in fact, Melvin Van Peebles trying to kill his son. Just make up for years of just failure.
No.
Whoops.
No.
Oh. Okay, well, now we've had enough fun. We should move on to tonight's real topic, which are the upcoming Oscars on the 24th.
Yes.
And which is why Stu has so graciously agreed to come out here. And after much hullabaloo, they are back on. With any luck, we'll have Jon Stewart hosting them.
What shall you be doing, Stu, in collaboration with the Oscars this year?
Well, that's a good question. I'm trying to decide. I was last year actually had an Oscar party, which is kind of awesome. And this year, I have been so busy, I haven't been able to plan one. So, but there's no reason why I can't just, like, you know, I guess it's like, you know,
have a spontaneous Oscar party.
Yeah, we can all just probably get together, like, probably here and have an Oscar party. So if you're listening to this, check in at The Reeler on, let's say, February, 21st, 22nd, around that time, and we'll have Oscar plans set up, or we won't.
You can all come to my house.
That's an exclusive for John and Vadim. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm either going to have an Oscar party or I'm not. Exclusive. You know? Yes or no?
And are you
going
to be, like, live blogging on Oscar night or anything?
No, I don't actually live blog the Oscars. What I do is the next day, I actually put together a recap of Oscar live blogs. So I will kind of rate them and see, like, who is worth viewing next year, who should, you know, basically, you know, never
fall into a hole and die.
Yeah, who should have their computer taken away.
So like the top 10 of top 10.
Similar to that. Yeah, it's kind of a media critical look at the phenomenon of Oscar live blogging, which is really just an abortion through and through, and she just
okay.
Stop.
So last year, who was best? Who was the worst?
The live blogs.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's a great question. I know who was the worst. Every year, I think it's Carrie Knowles himself who Oscar blogs.
Really?
Yeah, and
on Ain't It Cool?
On Ain't It Cool, exactly. And it's quite phenomenal, really. You know, everything is misspelled, everything is gleeful, emphatic, and poorly punctuated, and quite almost illiterate, really, you know?
That is shocking, considering Ain't It Cool. I don't know.
Yeah, and I mean, it sounds like I'm picking on an easy target, but really, I mean, it's not that hard to put together a succession of cogent thoughts when you basically have all night long and the next day to edit.
Right.
Right. So I don't think it's asking too much, but maybe it is. I mean,
who knows? But best.
The best?
Hands down best. Like, who are you looking to read this year that you're excited about?
You know, I don't even remember who the best was.
Is it David Carr?
David Carr does not live blog.
Really? Does he?
To my knowledge. No, he actually, I mean, I guess technically he does in a way. I mean, a live blog, like, officially a live blog, official definition is like one post that's constantly updated. So you add a time stamp on it and a thought and a refresher or something like that. You know, so Carr will basically do like 7, 8, 9 posts an hour or something like that, but he won't, you know, just keep repeating the same post. And so in that sense, I do like David Carr's stuff a lot. I've always been really hard on him in the past, but I, you know, give credit where credit is due. I think, you know, his Oscar stuff is really good. He admits he doesn't know anything about what he's talking about pretty much, and he admits that. But he has, you know, some background, some knowledge, and you know, he's got a good sense of humor about it. I like it a lot. So I guess technically, yeah, I would give him some credit for that, sure.
And now let's go into the main contenders.
Yes.
But first, I want to start out on a personal one. Best animated feature, which are, to my knowledge, Ratatouille, Surf's Up, and I'm blanking on the third film.
Persepolis.
Okay. Yeah.
How the fuck did Surf's Up get nominated? Like,
it's the penguins.
It's the penguins. Okay. Thanks for clarifying that.
Happy Feet last year, so it's sort of like residual Happy Feet.
But this is after you have such films being nominated for a potential nomination, like Tekkonkin Creed, Aqua Teen Hunger Force, which, you know,
those were both never going to happen.
But still, Tekkonkin Creed had a real chance. I mean, it was beautifully done, well shot. I think it was a crime that that was nominated over Paprika, because Paprika is, in my opinion, the best animated film of the year.
Okay.
Like, with how Khan treats 2D and 3D services, it's incredible. And yet, they would not give him the nod, but they would give Tekkonkin Creed, which was directed by an American,
right,
the nod. And I still think that's a bit of like a...
And so then are you leaning into something with Persepolis and like how it...
Well, Persepolis I think was given it because it got shut out of Best Picture, Best Foreign Film, and I think this was the booby prize of...
I thought it was Francis nominee.
Was it Francis nominee?
I believe it was.
Well, it was Francis' submission for Best Foreign Language Film, but it was not nominated for
Persepolis basically got the booby prize. If it doesn't win, it'll be like the ultimate smackdown. And if Surf's Up beats Persepolis, that would be the single saddest moment ever. And it probably will happen. Matter of fact, too, will win.
Well, what's going to be interesting for me, I think, is since Ebert put Crash as his best film of 2005 or 6 or whatever it was, and then that won Best Picture, I wonder if his placing Juno at the top of his list is going to increase that film's chances for walking away with the prize.
No, he actually came with his predictions a couple days ago, and he did favor No Country for Old Men as his best picture winner. He did say, however, that Ellen Page won Best Actress, and he said that's where his heart sabotaged his brain. I think, you know, maybe not, but I mean, basically, it's another expert marketing job by Fox Searchlight to position that film where it's positioned for this year's Oscar race.
Right,
last year's Little Miss Sunshine, this year they've done the same thing with Juno. Hats off to them. It's a good film. I like it. I like Ellen Page. I like everything about the film. It's fine, but it's not a... It's just I don't get the you know, sweeping platitudes that are meeting it, you know, for its Oscar run.
Well, do you think it's being pushed this way in order to replicate Little Miss Sunshine's overall quote unquote indiness? I mean, it seems like Juno is being pushed in order to show that little films can make it in the big bad scary award world.
Well, certainly the Oscars are all about replicating successes of years past in some way, shape, or form.
But does this mean then we're gonna like ignore films like There Will Be Blood, Dottie Belle, No Country?
Yeah, to satiate old prejudices, sure. I could see that happening.
I'm reading for a film, man.
You know, I mean, it's sort of I did a podcast with the Movie Geeks United, and we did an Oscar podcast, and I think we were talking about the supporting actress in which like Ruby Dee is nominated, and the girl from Atonement, and it was sort of like, gee, are they going to give it to the child or the black woman? You know, honestly, I kind of feel that's how you have to think with these with the Oscar voters at large. I'm not saying everyone feels this way, but when you get into the mass group think perspective of this particular award show, I think you start start to look at, you know, where the color blindness or the age blindness or you know, even the gender biases. What's the topic? I mean, what are the topics this year? It's kind of like...
Well, it's like our presidential race.
Wow. Well, there was an interesting article in Variety about this that I linked to today on The Reeler, where the author was trying to pinpoint the social issues in this year's Best Picture nominees. And he made an interesting point that I totally disagree with, but it was the first time I'd heard this, where he kind of equated the themes of There Will Be Blood with the oil for blood context of the Afghanistan and Iraq war front. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, well, that's bullshit. I don't buy that at all. I don't think there's a...
But I think that thing had brought up repeatedly at the press, which was incredibly retarded.
Yeah, I mean, I understand the arguments for, you know, the capitalism, you know, metaphor and the Christianity metaphor and the greed metaphor, but the blood for oil metaphors, I mean, that's basically people reaching. I really appreciate everyone trying to, you know, boost their IQ or the appearance of their IQ, you know, on the back of these films that really don't have these themes working, I don't think. I really don't think Paul Thomas Anderson has a metaphorical bone in his body. I just think he's a strictly technical filmmaker, a narrative filmmaker who deals with characters. And I think it's really that simple. I guess maybe I'm taking things too literally, perhaps, but I think the Coens are very much the same way. And that's the beauty of cinema, though. We read things into these films, and obviously everyone's entitled. I just don't think that there's any one right interpretation. I keep seeing that, though. Everyone thinks there's one right interpretation. And the Oscars...
With these two films specifically, though, like to an insane sort of degree, right?
Yeah, I digressed a bit. The piece was talking about the themes also in Juno. Teen pregnancy is a major issue now, which, right. You know, because also last year you had Knocked Up, you had Waitress, and of course Four Months, 2 Weeks, 2 Days, there, you know, was the kind of holy trinity plus the Romanian one of you know, pregnant chick movies. And, you know, I don't think that really... I don't know why that has to mean something. I just think that happens to be, you know, like, writers happen to have the same idea at the same time.
Lou Lemonick famously saying that he thought D'Alba Cody was a great writer because she was really hot. And that seems like...
stripper.
Yeah. And Google Image Search, it's great.
And you know what? That's sort of an illustration of Oscar voter mentality.
It is.
That's
absolutely.
Right there.
That's the basis on which Diablo Cody's chances are being judged, by her backstory, not, you know, necessarily by the context or the content of the screenplay she wrote.
So then are the major awards voters in the Oscars like old biddies with like a stripper fetish or lesbian undertones?
That's why I don't think Juno's going to win Best Screenplay. That's one of the reasons why.
But isn't it for, is that for Best Original? Or
Best Original Screenplay.
Best Original.
Yeah, there are sub-reasons I think it won't win, and that's one of them, is that I think people overrate the entire backstory. I think the general public is interested in the backstory. The media is certainly interested in it.
It's not a matter of the backstory, but it's the fact that we've been forced by this entire backstory of this wacky character of Diablo Cody, and wow, isn't she so great? And here, she's got a column in Entertainment Weekly, and like, she's so incredible. Like, we've been forced by this writer, and like the famous, I think it was like a joke video on YouTube, but at a screening, a student journalist walks up to Jason Reitman and goes, "Oh, hi, you're Jason Reitman." He goes, "Yes." And the journalist goes, "So what did you do in Juno?" I mean, that's been the big thing. The entire thing is now about focusing on either Ellen Page or Diablo Cody, and that's it. Everyone else,
speaking of force fed, I just saw the Entertainment Weekly cover, I think, on Scanner's Jim Emerson's blog today with Daniel Day-Lewis and Javier Bardem on the cover. And it's like, right there in the headline, it says, "Two surefire Oscar winners," or something like that. So it's like, you know, automatically there's all this presumption from all these different circles that creates, you know, I don't really know what, but I mean, it's sort of like, you know, it's like being shouted down. There is no chance for real any democracy in the votes or whatever. You know? I mean, it always was a popularity contest, but it always seems to be a bit more now with like the widespread.
But the minute Daniel Day-Lewis said drainage,
drainage.
Thank you. And Anton Chigurh came on and said, "This is your lucky coin. Yeah. Do not put it in your pocket." Right then, there, people went, "Oh, great! Best actor, best supporting actor."
Yeah, and then
those are actually the correct choices, though.
And that's
never mattered.
And the thing thing, of course, is that I, even though I don't really like No Country for Old Men, I do love There Will Be Blood. I mean, those performances are very much award-worthy in what they're trying to do, I think, and what they do, so, you know. Yeah, so it's sort of like, sometimes your taste in the Oscars coincide. You know, like, I believe Silence of the Lambs should have won everything it won in 91.
Let's turn back to Stu for a minute and get his take on the entire aspect of, are the Oscars going to be There Will Be Blood, No Country, Juno, and that's it?
No, I don't think so. I think, I mean, the...
Like, is Diving Bell and the Butterfly going to do anything? Because it seems like that is
no.
the...
No, the Diving Bell and the Butterfly will not do anything. It's going to be one of those things where it's a pleasure to be nominated, it was an honor to be nominated, and it's going to go home empty-handed.
Atonement?
No, Atonement won't do anything either. I think, you know, even it's... I think, if I'm not mistaken, it got nominated for that dress that Keira Knightley wore, but you know, it can't even win in that category because the costume designer for La Vie en Rose died last year. So you can't lose if you're dead. That's just the bottom. I think it's like an unwritten rule of the Oscars. You know, always have to win. So I think that, you know, it's gonna, you know, the whole actress category is touchy. I don't think Ellen Page is, you know, is awesome. I mean, I don't think she's Oscar worthy. It doesn't really matter what I think. I've always said that Marion Cotillard is someone to beat because she's got Picture House behind her. Never underestimate Bob Burney. He's gonna get her as close as he can to the finish line, if not across it first. So, and yeah, like No Country is gonna win Best Picture, and I think the big thing is screenplay. I really, really think Michael Clayton is gonna come back and take the screenplay.
That would be awesome. Award. If Gilroy could come back in at the last minute and just.
It is interesting because there's all this kind of like resurgence of interest in Michael Clayton that I'm seeing.
Well, do you think this is in part due to the media? Like, it seems like every online outlet and every paper has suddenly, after the whole Juno, and then the Juno backlash started to occur, suddenly everyone comes back and says, wait a minute, hey, what was that film with George Clooney? Yeah, you know, the one, he was a lawyer. Michael Clayton, who wrote, oh no, Tony Gilmore, yeah, wait, that was actually really good. Let's get that back out in theaters.
Right.
Let's have that fight against Juno again. And out of nowhere, you have the Dark Horse. Like, it seems like people got fed up with the hamburger phone and said, fuck, how about we actually have a good film brought in for screenplay?
It's a fine film. What are the other nominees? I don't even remember.
Are you talking about the original screenplay nominees?
Yeah.
Well, look, it's Tamara Jenkins, it's Nancy Oliver, it's Brad Bird. Those three are not going to
win. Okay, so then it actually is the best choice.
It comes down to Diablo Cody or Tony Gilroy. And look, I mean, I wrote about this for Vanity Fair, and I said the exact same thing. I said, if you have nominees, Juno is nominated for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, and Best Screenplay. So four awards, four major categories. Now, it has to win something, right? Especially if it's made $105, $106 million. What's it made now? $110 million?
Maybe even more than that.
Yeah, exactly. So everyone's saying, well, it has to win something, can't go home empty-handed. But I'm saying, well, look, Michael Clayton has the exact same thing. It hasn't made that much money, but it's been nominated for even more Oscars, many in the same category, and I don't think Tilda Swinton's going to win in Best Supporting Actress, which is his best shot of winning inside the screenplay category, because it's got Ruby Dee and Cate Blanchett there. So I think, you know, it's going to come down to, they have to give one of those films an award in something, and it's going to come down to the screenplay prize. I really believe that.
So screenplay is the one to watch this year. Like, that'll be the big...
I think original screenplay is the one to watch.
Nice.
I really do, because everything else, and supporting actors as well, because I think that's going to have a lot, because that award usually comes first in the show. It's going to be interesting to kind of see what happens with that, and I think that's going to set the tone for a lot of the night, at least for the prognosticators and the Oscar wonks.
Can someone explain to me why Cate Blanchett has been nominated at all for out there
for her hair, you know.
Yeah, no, aside from makeup and effects, which should go to the respective award categories. Really,
because Harvey Weinstein said, "When I'm not there," came out that I am going to make Cate Blanchett get an Academy Award nomination for her role as Bob Dylan.
I'm going to kill myself.
Right. And so I don't think that the Academy wants Harvey Weinstein's blood on their hands.
Absolutely not.
So they were like, "Okay, we'll give Cate that." And oh, look, she was Elizabeth again. Woo! You know, so
spectacular.
You
know.
It's only in the final voting that the Academy doesn't like being told what to do.
Yeah.
Everything else, it's very, very compliant. But when it comes to the final voting, in, you know, many categories, it turns out, yeah, there won't be many upsets. Like actor, for example, as we were discussing, supporting actor, probably best picture. But, you know, there are things like supporting actors where, you know, yeah, they're going to nominate Kate Blanchett because they have to. You know, it's a rejection of the entire critical culture for them to say, oh, no, we're going to go for someone else. And it's a very competitive category this year. They could have probably gone for someone else. But, you know, but alas.
Well, now, here's a question. I mean, we talk about all these things around the Oscars, and we're sort of like, you know, poo-pooing and or shooting down things. But are we talking about them with any kind of effort to try and change them, or do we just sort of accept this as the state of things? It's always going to be the state of things. We're just kind of amused and amused by it.
As long as we have the ever-present ghost of Jack Valenti influencing everyone and everyone in Hollywood, there's no way we're going to change it. Even as Vadim so eloquently put last week, critics, unless we tell people that, you know, I liked it or I didn't like it,
yes,
then no one's really going to care. And until then, I mean, there'll always be a small subsection of poo-poo, but knowing that we're poo-pooing since we can't change it.
Right.
I mean, it's like...
So then are we amused by it? I mean, do we sort of get off on it in a way?
Yeah. Oh, come on, every...
I think so.
So in a sense, we love it, even though we...
Yes.
Well, I mean, the important thing is just to remember, like everything else, you got to keep everything in perspective. I mean, it is what it is. It's a show run by a relatively small cross-section of Hollywood professionals. And, you know, they are pressured by the media, and the media thinks it has some power. And, you know, there's a back and forth there and a total disconnect from the real world, where there's over 600 films released every year, you know. And, yeah, not all of them are Oscar-worthy. Of course not. But, you know, I mean, it's the same thing as top 10 lists, which I go off on every single year. I mean, you know, the critics are just as bad. I mean, you guys anoint 10 fucking movies the best of the year. You know, so in the end it comes down to what, like 15, 20, 25 films, you know, some permutation of those films. Okay, well, what else is out there? I mean, come on, dude, is that the best we can do? And the Oscars are just kind of a crystallization of that, but it's so entrenched in our culture and our way of life. It's like baseball, you know? And it just has to be there. And I think the way it is fine, as long as we kind of recognize what it is. And we get to big red carpet and a lot of fucking expensive dresses and, you know, a bunch of people patting each other on the back.
Now, Vadim, you were shaking your head in response to something earlier.
I just watch it as a barometer of what Hollywood thinks of itself. It's completely useless to me. Like, someone pointed out earlier that If There Will Be Blood wins, it's going to be the first time, I mean, arguably, if you don't like Silence of the Lambs, you can go back to Annie Hall or whatever, but it's going to be the first time in a long time that a movie that's, like, default highbrow critic consensus favorite also wins Best Picture. That's why I'm rooting for Atonement to win, because if There Will Be Blood wins, I'm going to spit out my drink.
Yeah.
And
if There Will Be Blood wins, like, I never want to watch the Oscars again. It's going to be like my home team winning the world championship.
The conspiracy theory I always thought was that the No Country and There Will Be Blood voters might split each other's vote.
That's what I was thinking, yeah.
And then
I thought Juno might sneak in there somewhere.
Yeah. Right. But I still, you know, it's sad to be Atonement. You know, you're supposed to win Best Picture. You get the right property, you get the right novel, you make it British, and I actually kind of like Atonement, but I mean, you know, that's what the movie was made to do. It was made to win an Oscar. And it's got to be a sad time if you're Joe Wright.
Well, I still feel extremely bad about the Glenn Hansard controversy.
The which?
There's Glenn Hansard controversy?
It was a minor controversy. Like, okay, fine, not even a real controversy.
Oh, the fact that 3 out of the 5 Best Song nominees are from Once?
No, only one is from Once, and it almost got disqualified. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
There was a controversy because they said, well, was it written before Once came out? Was it written for the film, or was it written before that? And the whole, long story short, basically they said, yeah, they wrote it for the film, but the film took forever to get going, so Hansard started playing it at shows, and so it kind of became a part of his set, even while the film was still in development, and thus the film was not written for the film. Or the movie was, I'm sorry, the song was not written for the film. It all got straightened out. It's going to win. It's fine.
Either way, I'm
and that's another, and rightfully so.
Right.
Vadim. You know, I hate to say this, Vadim, but you know, you're the kind of guy that doesn't like fun. You know, unless it's Bishop.
I don't like fun. No,
but seriously, the fact that you didn't like once proves you are a bitter, angry young man.
That's some of the worst music I've ever paid to hear in my entire life. And they made a documentary about James Blunt's creative process, or the dude who wrote that song "Bad Day," and you had watched it, and he had a female collaborator. I mean, come on. The movie is actually quite good whenever they're not opening their mouths and wailing like neutered, you know, like ex-soldiers, like that guy who wrote the song "Bad Day." Okay, but. No, that was James Blunt. I'm sorry. I don't want to pay a disservice to the movie once.
Clearly, Vadim, at some point in your life, you've just had your soul stripped out of you and, like, filleted. You can even say it was impaled.
I love this though. I think it's great that, because I mean, I have talked to people who don't like the music, and that's what's important to me, and that's why I think, you know, I go back to something like Dreamgirls, which I at the time I walked out of there and I thought, wow, that was great, because I really like the presentation, I really like just like the production values. I just thought the whole thing was just so inspired, and Bill Condon, it meant so much to him, clearly. But the songs in the end were so fucking abysmal, they were awful. I think David Edelstein called it eardrum lacerating or something like that, and that's exactly how I felt when I left it. When I really started thinking about Dreamgirls, listening to the music again. Once, you know, if you don't like the music, then you're fucked. But I thought it was great. I really did. And Hairspray was another one where I thought that film could have, you know, it could have gone further if the songs were just a little bit better, you know? I think we got to have, like, one last go around, like, what everyone thinks they're, like, you know, like, the top five Oscar, you know, winners going to be. Picture, director, actor, actress.
That's why I invited Stu. So, Keith, you will go first.
Okay, what do we start with?
Top five in terms of what do we think we're going to, what's going
to
win?
I guess we can't do a top five. I guess in the end it has to be six, right? Because actor, actress, supporting actor, supporting actress, director, and picture. You want to do that? Or?
Okay, yes.
So, let's do it.
When do we start? Which topic?
Or just run down the list all six of yours at 110.
Best nominated, okay. Best picture, No Country. Best actor, help me with the nominees.
Daniel Day-Lewis.
He's gonna get it.
That was easy.
Best actress, help me name.
Marion Cotillard.
I'm going to say Cotillard because I don't want Cotillard to win. Very much so. Supporting actor, Bardem, I think. Supporting actress, who's there?
Swinton, D. Saoirse Ronan.
I would love Tilda Swinton to just get the award. You know, and I'm just going to say Tilda Swinton now is like the dark horse, because that woman deserves an award for her entire fucking career. And if it's for Michael Clayton, God bless her. You know, I mean, she's perfectly fine in that piece of shit movie, but I mean, you know, but yeah, I mean, just for like Orlando and all her work with Derek Jarman, and you know, just being a damn cool woman in general, and like walking out of the New York Film Festival party like she was the ultimate shit. I love that woman, and she deserves every award known to fucking man. Tilda Swinton. Okay, I proselytized. So,
Vadim?
All of those except I think Ellen Page actually. Page is closer to my age group, but besides that, I gotta give Juno something, and I don't see it being best.
Plus, I don't think you want to sleep with Marianne Cotillard in that makeup. So, yeah.
I like to say that movies I've seen might actually win. So,
I agree, but I will put Ellen Page in for best actress.
Yes.
Only because I want to meet her and reenact scenes from Hard Candy.
Yeah.
Well,
definitely.
Including the.
Oh,
all
especially.
Of it.
Oh, okay, there we go.
Just for the pleasure of her company, right. That would be nice.
Parts of Hard Candy and X3. That it'll be like the ultimate cosplay fantasy. It'll be great.
And then the illustrious Mr. Van Aerosdale. What do you think?
You know, I'm just gonna go totally on a limb and just get on a strictly emotional basis, not intellectual basis. I'm gonna say what I want to win, basically.
Go for it.
Just because I think in the end, I have to have a sense that, you know, I really I really feel good about the Oscars in the end. This is what it takes. So There Will Be Blood, Best Picture. Paul Thomas Anderson's going with the director. I think, you know, some phenomenal conscience attack will overtake Hollywood in the upcoming week. And or I guess by the time you hear this, we'll know. You know, the votes will be cast. But yeah, PTA, There Will Be Blood. I really think Marion Cotillard is going to win. That's not just an emotional pick. That's just she's going to win that award. And Daniel Day-Lewis, Javier Bardem, and Ruby Dee is Best Supporting Actress. She will give her 2.5-3 minute long acceptance speech while they're trying to cut her off, and she won't walk off the stage. And it's going to be great.
The black woman will triumph.
The black woman will pull Cuba.
There you go. Well, I'd love to see Ruby Dee doing, like, the Cuba Gooding Jr. speech.
Yeah. One-arm push-ups?
Kaveri, briefly.
Despite not having any real value in this conversation, I'm going to agree with Keith on the Tilda Swinton nod. Because she's a badass. Although, if you have any questions about travel, I'm the person to go to. Movies, not so much, but I know how to watch them and not fall asleep.
Hey, that's all I know how to do, too. It's great. It's got me this far. And on that note,
yes.
Episode 3 of Lakeman and Rizzo via the grassroots.
The untitled bootleg cut, like almost famous.
Oh no, this will be the untitled Academy screener edition of Lakeman and Rizzo live at Grassroots Tavern with special guests ST Van Arisdale and Kaveri. Until next time, if you see any of us at the bar, please buy us a drink. We'd appreciate it.
We love you. Good night.